I was so lucky with Luke as a baby, though I had no way of knowing this at first, no benchmark, no experience. To be frank, I was expecting it to be nigh impossible trying to run the business with a baby. Everyone went so heavy on the dire warnings when I was in the last stage of pregnancy. Brace yourself, they all said. Lack of sleep is a form of torture, they said. You'll have no time to yourself, no time even to take a bath in peace, blah-de-blah. I got to the point where I seriously worried whether I would be able to keep the business going at all. When does it get easier? I remember asking a friend with three girls. That was about 2 weeks before Luke arrived, and I will never forget her reply. Oh, it never gets easier, Ella. Just wait until they're teenagers. I went home that day and cried, catastrophizing that the flower shop would have to be sold. But do you know what? It wasn't nearly as difficult as they all predicted. Sure, I remember the panic outside the hospital when we couldn't even strap him into the car seat, despite all our practicing. I remember the sense of shock that they were actually going to allow us to take this tiny bundle home when we had not the foggiest what we were doing. I remember also waking in the night, between feeds in those early weeks, convinced I had forgotten to put him back in his Moses basket and fearing he had fallen off the bed. Where's the baby, Tony? Where did I put the baby? But it was a surprise how quickly it all settled down. Luke was this really placid, smiley baby, you see. An easy baby. My mum came to stay, and I had to bring in help to keep the shop ticking over, but by week 10, Luke was sleeping through the night. He was the kind of child who, once fed and clean, was happy to amuse himself. I could pop him on a mat with a mobile overhead, and he would just smile and coo. You were never like this, my mother said. He must get it from his father. Luke's placid nature meant I started back at the shop much sooner than planned. We put up a hook from the ceiling and bought him one of those bouncy contraptions. He would sit in his little bouncy sling for hours, just jiggling up and down, watching me putting orders together and gurgling at all the customers. Bounce, gurgle, bounce, smile. I have been sitting on the bed here for goodness knows how long, replaying all these pictures of Luke in my head. I smooth the fabric of my trousers. I have been worrying what to wear, but I'm not changing. It doesn't matter what you're wearing, Ella. What you're wearing won't change this or fix it. What matters is that my son, my beautiful Luke, has been going through hell, and I had no idea. None at all. I have been so distracted, thinking about Anna and her family in Cornwall and the blessed postcards, that I have not seen what is right here under my nose, that my poor son's life is in meltdown. I was so shocked when he finally blurted it out. Again, so naive. I didn't even realize they were having sex. You ready, love? Tony is standing in the doorway. Luke's downstairs. Yeah, sure. In the sitting room, I repeat to Luke what I have said so many times in the last 24 hours, that the time for regret, and if only, is over, and we have to look this in the face now. All of us, together. Reminding him that he is not on his own with this any more. If she wants to go ahead and have this baby, we should support her. As a family. Luke should not feel that this has to involve them living as a couple, or settling down. They are far too young for that. But he does have to offer to play a part in this child's life, to be a support, to face up to what has happened here. And we will support him, them, the baby. Luke's face is white. Tony's face is white. I wonder if I am the only one thinking how much more terrible it is for Emily's parents. She is 16. We drive in silence. 20 minutes. Luke offers directions for the final mile. The fact that we do not even know where his girlfriend lives says everything about the situation. I gave him lifts to the cinema. They met in town, took the bus. I wonder where exactly they have been having sex. This thought leads me back to the train, to Sarah and that man. Wondering how they could do that in a train toilet. And no, the irony isn't lost on me, remembering my shock. Me and my high horse. I put on the radio, but Luke asks me if I will turn it off, please. Left at the post box. Second right. There. It's the detached house at the end of this cul-de-sac. That one. A nice house. Red brick with a climber around the porch. The windows look freshly painted, and the front garden is immaculate. Neatly clipped lawn and beds of roses, and lots of hardy geraniums. I don't know why I take all of this in. Maybe it is because I don't really want to get out of the car. So, you ready, son? It is Tony who moves us forward, opens his door first. Luke shrugs. I look at him and see that he is still in shock. He keeps saying that they used protection. We used a condom. I don't understand. Like I say, love, it is what it is. We're here for you, I say. Now, come on, let's go in. Emily's parents introduce themselves, but we don't shake hands. None of us are going to pretend. Emily is sitting all hunched up in a wide armchair, cushioned to her stomach, as white as Luke. Emily didn't want us to meet like this, but we felt, given how young they are, that a joint meeting was important. Rebecca sounds as if she has rehearsed this. I notice that her husband has his eyes fixed on Luke. I can only imagine what may be going through his head, but I want to erase what he is thinking. He is a good lad, Luke. He has stuffed up, yes, but so has she. And I wish I had the courage to tell the father to stop looking at my son like that. Emily and Luke have been talking a lot about the options, but we feel we should know where the two families stand, going forward. Rebecca is looking at me. Well, I think you're right. It's important for us to talk. And the first thing I want to say is how sorry we are, as you must be. Devastated, actually, that they find themselves in this situation so very young. I can feel Tony's eyes on me, and he tilts his head, a tiny sign of encouragement, before speaking up to help me. My understanding is that they did try to be sensible, to be safe. Tony turns to Emily's father, but the response is a cold stare. She's 16.
Dad, please.
Emily glances across at Luke, who is still white, staring at the ground. What we want to make clear, I glance at Tony again and then back at Emily's parents, is that as a family we will do whatever we can to support Emily. Emily has decided against a termination. We want to be open about that. But she may want to consider adoption. I feel a punch of shock at this. Our grandchild. Rebecca is looking her daughter in the eye. We are still talking this through as a family. She has a lot to consider. A-levels. University. Her voice breaks, and I feel this terrible surge in the pit of my stomach. Perhaps we can talk again about this. Tony clears his throat to continue. We feel this should be Emily's decision. Rebecca is now looking at her husband. She will talk it through with Luke, of course, but we just wanted to check where we all stood, in terms of support. I've already told Emily that I'll support her. Luke is looking straight at her. I've told her that. Yes. Well, maybe you should have thought about the consequences before you...
Dad, please don't. Please.
Emily's voice is almost unbearably quiet. So, is there anything else in particular that you need to know from us today, other than that Emily and Luke have our full support? I can feel my left fist clenching with the tension. No. Rebecca tilts up her chin. We just wanted to make absolutely sure that everyone knows where we are. She stands, and I realize this is the cue for us to leave, that this was only ever about ensuring that Luke came clean with us. I hand a piece of paper with my personal email address to Rebecca. Thank you. And then we part in silence. No handshakes, nothing more to say. We drive back to the house in silence, too. It is real now. At 17 years of age, Luke is about to become a father. I want to speak up, to say that I will bring up the baby, that they must not, under any circumstances, give the child away. Luke's child. And then, as we pull into the drive, there is another shock. Sticking through the letterbox is a new postcard. Half in, half out. No envelope this time, and unmistakable. Black with bright lettering. It is 8 o'clock in the evening, which means that whoever is doing this has been to the house. I feel utterly overwhelmed as I stand outside the porch, imagining that other person standing in precisely the same spot. I am terrified of what this now means, for me and for my family. I realize that I should have gone straight to the police, told Tony, that I am properly afraid that everything is running away from me. I realize also that tonight shouldn't be about me and Anna, and whatever these postcards may or may not mean. Tonight should be about Luke. Watching. 9 p.m. I like that she is not sure. That is why I like to watch people. Have to do this. I don't even remember how it began anymore. Only that it has become important. You need to watch, you see, because it is extremely important to work out the difference between how people behave when they know they are being watched and when they don't. Some people, you see, are much the same whether they are being watched or not, but most people aren't. You don't get to find out for sure until you watch a lot. Sometimes, and this is also important, you don't need to do anything very much. People will simply come to know, give themselves away. Then the watching becomes more interesting, because they will eventually turn to a window, or in exactly the right direction, and they will pull a blind or the curtains, turn on a light, or check a door. Other times I have to help them out a bit, stir it up, until I can see the look that I have come to understand, and is probably the thing I like the very best. When someone feels they are being watched, but is no longer absolutely sure. Chapter 14. The Friend. Sarah is sitting up in bed, staring at the cold cup of tea on her locker. Why does her mother keep bringing her tea? She doesn't like the hospital tea. It smells funny. Her arm is still sore from the drip. At first, she didn't understand why all of this fussing had to go on for so long. She thought she would get her stomach pumped, puke a bit, say sorry, go home. But no. No one tells you the truth of this. But then why would they? Anyone taking an overdose is supposed to want to die, so why would survival details matter? The problem, Sarah realizes, still staring at the cold tea, is that she doesn't ever remember thinking that she actually wanted to die. She no longer remembers precisely what she was thinking when she took the tablets. There was just all this panic about what would come out on the new TV appeal, that maybe everyone would find out about what happened on the train, what really happened in the club. Yes, just panic, wanting everything to stop. But not a conscious choice to check out. Die. Not that. Not really. And she certainly doesn't want to die now. Which is why it is so frightening to have to face up to the details. The obsession with her liver. All the tests. The whispering. The consultant looking so terribly grave when examining her charts. Sarah can feel her hands trembling. When she looks down at them, they are actually shaking, and she wishes that she had not looked it all up on the internet. She wonders what dying really feels like, if it would really hurt, if you would know. For a moment, this makes her think of Anna, but she shuts this down. No, Anna is going to be found. Anna has to be found. It is like this twisted wrenching through her whole body, so torn, wanting Anna back, but not wanting to be found out. In the meantime, Sarah's mother is trying to play down the tests. She keeps using her sing-song voice, saying everything is going to be just fine. But everything is not fine. Her liver tests are still borderline. It is day 4. Day 4 is apparently a very bad place to be. They have given her back her phone, and so yes, she has looked it up. Loads of people die of liver failure on day 4. Turns out surviving the paracetamol overdose doesn't put you in the clear at all. Is my liver going to pack up, Mum? Stop it, Sarah. You're going to be fine. Not true. Her results are so borderline, she might need a transplant. It could go either way. It's hard to tell with livers, apparently. She's had charcoal, and she's had the drug by drip that's supposed to help the liver cope with all this, but nothing is guaranteed. It's a waiting game. What Sarah wants more than anything is her sister, Lily. But her mum won't talk about Lily, so all she has been able to do is message her on Facebook. But Lily hasn't replied yet, hasn't updated her status for ages. The last picture was at some weird yoga retreat. There is the sound of the curtain around her bed now. Her mother is back from the shop downstairs. I bought you these. She has two magazines in her hand and the hospital cliché of grapes. Sarah looks at her mother and feels a familiar and confusing myriad of emotions. Love, anger, frustration. I'd better phone your father. Tell him how you're doing. No, don't. I don't want him here. I want Lily. Now come on, Sarah. He has a right to know the latest if he wants to come. Don't! I said I don't want him here, and I mean it. Why won't you talk about Lily? Lily made her own choices. Lily has her own life now. Your dad, he's been very worried. Sarah turns away. Bad enough that he had insisted on coming to the hotel in London to talk with the police, kept phoning, checking up. Maybe he was worried what she might say to the police. Sarah looks at her mother, fussing with the grapes and the magazines, moving the box of tissues and pouring cordial from a bottle. How many times has she tried to broach it, to talk to her mother, to take the pin out of the grenade? But it's always like this. She is dismissed, shut down. The pin is popped straight back in. The pretense remains that their family is just a standard broken family, all very straightforward. Sad, but neat. Nothing out of the ordinary. Loads of people get divorced after all. Your father is gone, but we are going to be fine. It is all going to be civilized. We both love you very much still. Occasionally, over the years, Sarah wondered about sharing the truth with Anna. But Anna had such a different life. Beautiful Anna, with her beautiful life. Sarah leans back into the plumped-up pillows and closes her eyes. That's it, love. You have yourself a nice little nap. I'll read. They met in the third year of primary school, she and Anna. Back then, Sarah's dad was a lorry driver and away a lot. Her mother had always wanted to live in the country, so they bought a little two-bed modern terrace on a small estate on the outskirts of the village. Sarah remembers how very shocked she was when Anna first invited her home to tea. The drive along the narrow lane to the huge farmhouse, with its chaos and its dogs and its line of Wellingtons in the boot room, which was bigger than her mother's kitchen. Imagine, she told her family, a whole room just for boots and dogs. It's nuts. That first night after visiting the farmhouse, Sarah lay in bed, overwhelmed. Tea at hers after school was tinned spaghetti on toast or oven chips made into chip butties. Only at weekends was there more effort, and even then it was from packets and tins. At Anna's, it had been surreal. Her mother made this incredible stew, rich and delicious with herb dumplings on top, and apple crumble with homemade custard. It was a Wednesday, and Sarah had imagined it was a big and special fuss for her, but Anna said no, just a normal tea. Why? What do you like to eat? Anna's father came in from the fields to eat with them and was charming and funny, telling jokes, sitting at the table in his thick woolen socks and asking Sarah if she would like to come with Anna to see some of the new lambs. Sarah looked around the table, watching Anna very closely, and it was like stepping back to watch from inside a strange bubble, realizing that this really was their version of normal, not a show put on for a visitor at all. Anna's norm, Anna's very different life. And it wasn't exactly jealousy she felt, but there was this awareness, a stirring inside that was uncomfortable, because it was the first time she had had her own life thrown into such sharp relief. Anna was so different from her in other ways, too. Beautiful and kind and patient. She had been the first to befriend Sarah when she was standing awkwardly in the playground, the new girl. Anna had invited her to join in with a skipping game, and later to play two ball against the wall, chanting rhymes as they each took a turn, moving in to juggle the balls without letting them drop. They were thrilled to discover it was a shared passion, the two ball. They became known as the best in the school. That's really how it all began. Anna and Sarah, best friends forever. It was a long time before Sarah had the courage to return Anna's invitations. She had probably had tea at the farmhouse dozens of times by then. Stews and pies, lasagna and all manner of delicious offerings, always with a pudding to follow. Anna's favourite was this plum slice, like a flapjack with stewed fruit through the middle. It had a lovely smell, which Anna said was cinnamon. They would eat them cold as snacks some days when they played two ball in the yard, and other times Anna's mother would warm them for pudding to be served with clotted cream or custard. Often Jenny, Anna's sister, would have friends for tea too, and the table would be crowded and noisy, like a party. Tim and Paul were regulars. Sarah was pleased because Tim was from the council estate, and she liked that she wasn't the only one with a very different life. In fact, it made her feel better that Tim's mother apparently never cooked at all. She pretty much left him to fend for himself, which was why Mrs. Ballard loved to spoil him, and everyone else, too, with her open house, her hot pots, and her upside-down cakes. Very quickly, they became this little gang, with the farmhouse as their personal playground. They set up a camp in the bushes near the barns. On warm days, Mrs. Ballard put a sprinkler on the front lawn so they could run in and out of the water in their swimming costumes before tea. Mr. Ballard let them all ride in a trailer behind the quad bike, with the boys shouting, "Faster! Faster!" That first summer, the farm became a second home to Sarah. She was so happy. And then suddenly, nearer Christmas, Anna asked outright, "Could I not come to your house sometime, do you think, Sarah?" "I suppose." Sarah had felt this twisted sense of nerves and shame and guilt, too, wanting to be proud of her family, but worrying what Anna might think. She couldn't understand why someone who had such a wonderful home herself would want to go anywhere else. But if Anna was surprised by their tiny house and the oven chips and the baked beans, she certainly didn't show it. "It's so warm," she said, as they snuggled up to watch television downstairs, under the throw her mother had offered them. "Your house is so warm, Sarah. Ours is always freezing in the winter." They stayed best friends into secondary school, where Sarah discovered something special of her own, that she was actually a lot smarter than she realized. It had been difficult to tell in the small pond that was the village primary. She always came top in the spelling tests. Her writing was always displayed on the wall, and she always got an A for maths. But there was very little competition. Then, in secondary school, Sarah's stars suddenly shone more brightly. Top sets for everything, even maths, which Anna found a struggle. Sarah took on a new role in their friendship, which made her feel proud and valued and able to offer something important back to the family who had been so kind to her. She helped Anna with her maths homework, her essays. Paul was bright too, and it became a joke that he and Sarah were the boffins. Paul was the son of one of Mrs. Ballard's friends, and when he suddenly grew taller and quite handsome, Sarah looked forward to her visits to the farmhouse even more. Anna's mum and dad continued with the open-door policy even as the children grew, eating more, loudly chasing each other, climbing trees and playing hide-and-seek around the barns. Other parents complained about the noise and the food and the music and the mess, but Mrs. Ballard never seemed to mind at all. For a spell, with Sarah and Paul helping the others with their homework, over plates of pizza and cakes and scones. Everything felt so beautifully balanced, giving and taking, happy and good. Yes, she remembered that golden period, during the first year of secondary school, as the happiest she had ever been. Until, that is, the very end of that year. Another summer term. Sarah was 12, nudging 13. Her mother was away, visiting an old school friend, and out of the blue, Sarah's period started. Her sister Lily was around at a friend's house for a sleepover, and so Sarah began rummaging through her sister's chest of drawers, desperate for some sanitary towels. Stick-on ones, hopefully, with wings, which she had seen in adverts and looked pretty simple to use. But all she could find were tiny tampons in a box. She was horrified, opening out the instructions, trying to figure it out as her father came in. Very soon Sarah was in tears, absolutely mortified while he was telling her not to be so silly, that it was nothing to be worried or embarrassed about, all perfectly normal. Of course it would feel a bit awkward, and he was so sorry that her mother was away for the night, but she was not to be afraid or upset. This was just a part of growing up. He put his arm around her shoulders, and for a moment, Sarah felt so very happy and relieved that she had the kind of father who wasn't fazed by this, who could talk about this stuff without it being truly dreadful and awkward. And then he took the instructions from her hand, the leaflet about the tampons. And he said the problem was that these were really for older girls, and probably not suitable just yet. Sarah was about to ask if he could take her to the chemist to buy some of the sticky-backed sanitary towels, when her father said the important thing was to check, so as not to do any damage. Sorry? Well, if you let me have a look, see how grown up you are. You know, down there. We can work out if you can try the tampon straight away.
No, it's fine. I'll wait till Mum gets back.
Don't be silly. There is absolutely no need for you to be embarrassed about this. Periods are perfectly normal, not dirty or anything to be ashamed about. Looking back, Sarah knows, as she knew deep down at the time, that this wasn't okay at all. But she was in such complete shock, had no time to process the situation. And so she did the most terrible thing, and also the only thing. She let him look. She let him feel whether she was grown up enough. And then he said, no, probably not suitable for tampons. Not yet. That he would pop to the shops and get something else for her. No need to be embarrassed. She had sat on her bed with tissues stuffed in her pants to soak up the blood, frozen, unable to move. Just sat there in this terrible silence. It was as if her whole life had shrunk suddenly into this tight, tight ball that hurt as much as the pain in her stomach. And the problem is, she still doesn't know what to do, or what even to think. She still hasn't told her mother, or anyone else. Not Anna, not anyone. The pin is still in the grenade. When her parents separated very suddenly, she just refused to go and visit her father, which made both her parents very angry.
You didn't drink your tea.
Her mother is moving the cup on the locker to set out the grapes, removing the cellophane wrapping. Sarah looks at her. She looks at the cup of cold tea in her hand. And the worst thing now? She cannot get out of her head how her father was always saying how very beautiful Anna was. At school concerts, at parent evenings. Everyone said that, to be fair, but Sarah has been thinking, with all these hours stuck in the hospital with nothing to do but think, that her father said that a lot more than most, certainly more than felt comfortable. She is very lovely, your friend Anna. Very lovely girl.
Anna's mother, Barbara, phoned to see how you're doing. Everyone sends their love. Apparently the vigil went very well. It was on the local news, and the gang was wondering if they could come and visit. Cheer you up?
The gang?
Yes, Jenny and Tim and Paul. They're very worried about you and would love to pop by.
No, I don't want that. Not yet.
Right. Well, if you're not feeling up to it. But it will probably be good for you. Barbara seemed very keen. You know how fond of you she is.
I said not yet, okay? When I'm home. Maybe when I'm home.
Sarah cannot think about that now. She is suddenly thinking about a lot of other, more important and confusing things. How she hasn't told the police the truth about what happened with Anna in the club. And she hasn't told anyone about the text from her dad that night.
Chapter 15. The Witness. Sometimes people ask me, why flowers, Ella? The truth is, I cannot remember when life for me wasn't about flowers. Right from when I was tiny, and I used to collect wild flowers on walks with my gran, mesmerized by the colors and the scents, and the way you could make the whole impact and mood change by combining them in different ways. The simple, joyful sunburst of a huge fistful of primroses, then the softening and mellowing effect if you added in just a few bluebells for the surprise, the contrast, the hint of the Mediterranean with the blue and the yellow together. I would so love it when my mother let me pick flowers from the supermarket to put in vases at home, experimenting with the way they fell, learning how tulips only look right if you put them in precisely the right height of vase so they weep over the rim. Not too much, not too little. I have never forgotten the joy of learning to revive roses with fresh water and cutting the stems super sharp at an angle. The miracle of them lifting their heads again as if saying, thank you. It was no surprise that when I was old enough for a Saturday job, I knew precisely where I would try first. There was a small florist in the town I grew up in. I passed it every day on my walk to school, always stopping to examine the buckets of daffodils outside in the spring, glancing at the window displays. They wasn't especially inspirational, to be honest. Standard bouquets, standard displays, and too many carnations. But I have never been more proud than when I was offered my regular 6-hour Saturday shift. Up early to help sort the new stock, breathing in the heavenly scent of it all. The shiny ribbon, the rustle of tissue and cellophane. I learned very quickly to respect the popular tastes, the horror of those carnations and the ugly ferns. I was careful not to offend, biting my tongue at first. But as my confidence and my knowledge grew, I started to make little suggestions to our regulars. How about sunflowers or lilies? Something a bit different for a change. And it wasn't long before the manager, Sue, allowed me to order in new things and to make up my own little set-price bouquets. You have a really good eye, Ella. You're a natural. You should do a course. So I did. A basic course for starters, then a second, more advanced course for wedding flowers, and a third for contemporary design. After that, I entered a competition and made the local paper by winning a regional award. The prize was a week working with a top florist in London, visiting the flower markets at the crack of dawn. Scary, exhausting, exhilarating. Heaven. And then, the unimaginable. After I had finished A-levels, I did a year at college, floristry and business studies. During that year, my grandmother died, leaving an unexpected legacy to be shared between her 5 grandchildren. "No travelling," said my friends. Blow it on a car, or a world trip. No. Lying in bed at night, beaming, I knew exactly what I wanted to do. I managed to negotiate the lease on this place. A shop of my own. Complete madness, my parents said. Do you have any idea how many small businesses fail in their first year? And yes, they were right. In a way. It took much longer to come good than I expected. In truth, it provided little more than the minimum wage after costs in that first year, and let's not talk about the hours I put in. But it didn't fail. Quite the opposite by the time I got into my stride in the second and third years. I learned how to make the bread-and-butter earnings from weddings and seasonal holidays, Mother's Day, Valentine's Day. But the devil was definitely in the detail, I was sure of that. To compete with the supermarkets, I knew I had to offer something distinctive. My floral USP was an informal, shabby chic style with homemade touches that set us apart. My bouquets were hand-tied before this was common practice. I used unusual twine and handmade labels decorated with pressed flowers from blooms that had gone over. I learned to waste nothing. Discounted poses when I'd overordered, spent extra hours with the flower presses to ensure no waste. Soon I was selling little cards and labels, as well as using them on my bouquets, a very useful extra income stream. And so this is where I am happiest. My shop. My creation. Here in the shop, I do not worry so much what people think of me, or what I say. Whether I am old-fashioned or an old head on young shoulders, which is what everyone used to say when I set this place up. Here, where it is just 6 a.m. and the rest of the world is barely stirring, I am in my own little world, with orders to make up before we meet with the police back at the house, back in the real world, where Anna is still missing and the postcards have started to frighten Tony, as well as me. I work carefully. A birthday bouquet to be collected at noon, 6 table decorations for a dinner at one of the local hotels, 2 cups of coffee, 3. I work carefully, using my favorite secateurs, bright red handles with the sharpest blade on the market. Superb. And then, the strangest thing. At around 6:30, maybe 6:45, I leave the last of the table decorations on the counter, nearly finished, to use the loo, which is a tiny extension at the back of the unit. When I return to the bench, the secateurs are gone. There is the noise of a car right outside, and I admit it, I am spooked, thrown by this. I am normally so very careful with the secateurs, you see, not just because they are dangerous, but because they are extremely expensive. I don't want them to drop on the floor, for the handles to crack. They are a bit like a chef's favorite knife, a lucky charm. I have 2 spare sets in the drawers, but I don't feel comfortable using any others. They just don't feel the same in my hand. I walk to the front door to stare out to the parking area outside. A single car has its headlights on full beam, so I can't see who is inside. I check the shop door, unlocked. But then I don't normally worry about this. Whenever I am here, I consider myself open for business. If anyone spots the lights on and calls in early, I want to sell. We'll always take an order. But today, just this once, I put the latch across the top. I stand very still and find that my heart is pumping. I wait a little. 2 minutes, maybe more. Don't be so silly, Ella. Don't overthink this. And then the car finally pulls away, and I feel my shoulders move, reminding myself that the neighboring shops have flats above them, and this is not so surprising, this early movement. Probably just someone off to work. So I return to the workbench area at the back of the shop, and am totally confused. From this new angle through the archway to the serving area at the front, I can see the secateurs resting on the top of the till. I honestly don't remember putting them there. Can't ever remember putting them there before. There was a slight slope to the top of the till, and this doesn't seem the kind of thing I would do at all. What if they were to slide off? I look around me in the way you look around the kitchen when you can't find the ingredient you thought you had removed already from the fridge. I am tired. That's it. You are tired and you are on edge, overthinking and messing up, Ella. Tony was right. You should have stayed home and done this later. Way too many thoughts pumping around my brain. I finish up the final decoration quickly and store everything in the cooler near the workbench, a sort of flower fridge that keeps everything at the perfect temperature, all ready for my return. Back at the house, Tony is in the kitchen in his dressing gown. You okay? I've been worried. You should have let me come with you. It was fine. I wanted you here to speak to Luke. All done. His tone is just a little calmer now, but I can tell from the way he is standing, and also the dark shadows under his eyes, that he has not slept much either. He reacted just as I expected, more worried than cross. You should have told me, Ella. No more secrets. Which makes me feel terrible. I showed him the most recent postcard, but I haven't mentioned Matthew yet. I don't know how I feel about you working at the shop on your own now, early like this, I mean. Until we know precisely what is going on, what the police say. I wish you had listened to me, stayed home, or let me come with you. I had to get the orders done, Tony. And anyway, it will just turn out to be some saddo, a spotty teenager with nothing better to do. I cannot make this sound entirely convincing, because I no longer know what I think, what I believe, how scared I really ought to be. They called at the house, Ella. Whoever wrote that card called here, at the house. Yes, and you're right. It changes things. And I realize now that I should have told you right at the beginning, and I'm very sorry about that. But I am happy to take advice now. The police are going to be here in half an hour. I'll listen to whatever they say, Tony. The only reason I wasn't worried before is I honestly thought it was the mother. But we can rethink you working early on your own. If it will make you happier, I can try to juggle a bit in the future. I look him in the face. So, did you speak to Luke? Last night in bed, Tony was the one to say it first. Would you think I was mad if I said we should offer to adopt the baby? I cried and hugged him tight, so relieved that he was thinking exactly the same thing as me. We agreed we are too old, and it is probably completely insane, but there is no way we could let someone else bring up Luke's child if Emily's family can't cope. He says he'll mention it to Emily later. She's only 10 weeks, so it's a bit early for decisions. Tony puts his hand up to my cheek. I think he was relieved, but it's hard to tell. He's still in shock. Tony goes on to say Luke would like to stop working at the shop down the line. He's finding it too much with all the worrying. I completely understand, though I know it won't be easy to find a replacement. The early starts put people off. But Luke must come first, so we will have to work something out. Okay, so let's see what the police have to say, shall we? Talk again about Luke and the shop after that. I take his hand, still rested on my cheek, and kiss it. To be honest, I am surprised that we are to see the London DI. Apparently he is down for an update with the ballads in Cornwall, so we'll be calling in here on the way back. Matthew has updated me. His police contact friend handed over the earlier postcard. Nothing from forensics, no prints, but they want to see this new one too. I have put it in a transparent freezer bag. Matthew says they will provide proper evidence bags and special gloves for me to use if any more postcards turn up. Better chance of getting prints, apparently. He has asked me not to mention him by name, to imply that I handed the postcards over to the police myself. Tony has now stepped away and is looking under the sink, I assume, for fly spray. There's a blue bottle buzzing at the kitchen window. Eventually, he gives up on the cupboard and instead opens the window to shush the fly out with a piece of kitchen towel before turning back to me and tilting his head. You look really tired, Ella. You're doing all right, love. I'm fine. Just relieved you know about the postcards now. Chapter 16. The Father. Henry is sitting at a favourite spot on the stone wall, which has an overview of the higher, troublesome fields. There is just a little mist still hovering around the river below, but the sheep are safely across the other lane, and Sammy is happy. Henry smooths the dog's ears. It is moments like this, watching the early sun burning off the mist, that he feels the most calm. He is thinking that he would like to put in some more fencing lower down in the largest of these fields, to keep the sheep from the muddy slope down to the river. But fencing is expensive, and Barbara is not up for spending on the farm. New kitchens and power showers for the holiday cottages, bring it on. Paying some web designer to upgrade their search engine optimization, whatever that means, that apparently makes sense financially. But fencing, feed, tractor repairs. Henry looks down at the dog, whose tongue is lolling as he pants from the joy of checking the boundaries of this field, and the one next door. To Henry, this is what makes real sense still. A dog who happily races around the perimeter of every field he visits, returning to his master with a triumphant wag of the tail and meeting of the eyes to confirm that all boundaries have been checked. Henry glances at his watch. An hour to go. He ought to get back, have a shower, have another row with Barbara. Try one final time to calm things down before he faces the music proper. Come on then, boy. He deliberately takes the long way round. Cannot face Primrose Lane today. Back at the house, he is still in the boot room, hanging up his wax jacket, when Barbara appears.
Where have you been? We need to talk some more, Henry, before the police get here. I'm worried how much trouble I'll be in. We need to think of Jenny.
I'll come through. In the kitchen, she sits at the large, scrubbed pine table, drumming her fingers. He stares at the kettle alongside the arga, wondering about a cup of tea, but thinks better of it. Looks back at his wife.
I could be in serious trouble, Henry. I knew I should never have let you persuade me to lie to the police.
She is pulling at the sleeve of her jumper, stretching it, and then turning back the cuff.
It will be all right, Barbara. We're setting it all straight. They will understand. Will they? Will they really?
Henry closes his eyes. He is sorry that he has upset his wife. He is sorry that she is going through this on top of everything else, that he is a bad husband. But he is also very tired of having to say sorry a million times over, because it doesn't help or change anything. I'm sorry, Barbara.
Well, with respect, it's a bit late for that now. It's perjury, isn't it, to lie to the police?
I think that's just in court, love. Henry looks down at the floor, at his thick, grey woolen socks.
You disgust me.
Anna's voice again. In his head. In his car. In the passenger seat, refusing to look him in the face. And in this moment, he realizes that there isn't anything Barbara can say, or the police can say, to possibly make him feel worse than he already does.
I still don't understand why we had to lie, anyway. I mean, do you have any idea, Henry, how it was for me that night, eh? Here on my own, our daughter missing, me here, all on my own.
Henry closes his eyes and says nothing.
And by the way, I want you to move out. Oh, come on, Barbara, how is that going to help? Think of Jenny, and how am I going to keep the farm going if I move out? There is no farm, Henry. There hasn't been a farm for years.
He opens his eyes and meets hers. And you wonder why this isn't working out, Barbara. You marry a farmer, and then you decide that you don't want to be married to a farmer.
That isn't fair, isn't it?
They sit for several minutes, saying nothing at all.
Right. So we see them together, the police, Barbara. And I explain why I asked you to lie the night Anna went missing. It will be fine. We'll iron it out. I'm sorry I have upset you, but if you really want me to move out, then, with respect, I think what I do after today stops being any of your business. For now, I'm going to have a shower before they arrive.
Upstairs, under the stream of water which he turns up too hot deliberately, Henry feels the relief of it for the first time. The letting go. Finally. For years he has allowed himself the delusion that he can keep going like this. But now? Henry turns his face up into the stream of water and has to adjust the temperature as the jet burns the tender skin. And for a short time he does what he hasn't done since his mother died. In the stream of the hot water that turns his flesh just a little bit too red, Henry Ballard cries. He cries for Anna, who will never be found, and who knows the worst of him.
You disgust me, Dad.
Afterwards, Henry shaves for the second time that day, selects a blue checked shirt, a clean pair of jeans, and a navy sweatshirt. He does all of this on automatic pilot. He is long past the stage of trying to work out some script in his head. It will be what it will be. When they arrive, there are three of them. A local DS called Melanie Sanders, they have met a few times before, and who seems quite nice. Kathy, their family liaison officer, and the tall, slim DI from London, whom Henry has never liked. From the off, the mood is markedly different from previous encounters. Kathy accepts the offer of coffee, which Barbara brings to the table on a tray, but the DI declines.
I understand you want to speak to us, Mr. Ballard.
Yes, I'm sorry. I feel very bad about this, but I need to explain something about the night Anna went missing. I have something I want to clear up. The DI glances at the two women police officers and back at the Ballards. Interesting. We must be telepathic, you and me, Mr. Ballard, because I came all the way down here to talk to you about precisely the same thing. He does not even try to disguise the sarcasm in his tone or the little twist of the knife. You see, we had some very interesting calls after the anniversary appeal on television. Calls which we have found a little bit confusing. Henry looks at Barbara, whose expression is frozen. So why don't you go first, Mr. Ballard?
Okay. So, this is embarrassing. But I lied about the night Anna went missing, and I asked Barbara to back me up because I was so embarrassed, and I didn't want it to distract from your investigation.
Henry can feel his wife's stare burning into him.
This is completely my fault, not my wife's. I had a few too many to drink. I wasn't at home.
Not at home?
No.
And you telling us this now, changing your story, wouldn't have anything to do with the fact that you realize that we have new information.
No, of course not. How would I even know that?
Okay, Mr. Ballard. So, this new version of where you were the night your daughter went missing, will it go any way to explaining how your car was seen near the railway station that evening?
Excuse me?
Because, Mr. Ballard, I am here today to ask you how it is that your car was seen on the evening of Anna's disappearance near Hexton Railway Station, not here at the farm, as you and your wife both told us previously, but near a railway station, with a fast train to London. So my question is this. Did you go to London the night your daughter disappeared, Mr. Ballard? Is that what you really want to tell us?
Don't be ridiculous. Of course I didn't. I was here the following morning, when we were liaising with the police. You know I was. That wouldn't be possible. It's too far. How could I possibly...
Do you know what, Mr. Ballard? On reflection, I think it might be better if we continue this a little more formally, at the local police station. D.S. Melanie Sanders will give us access to one of her nice interview suites, I'm sure. Henry can feel a terrible panic rising within him, a sort of change of temperature which sweeps right through his body. His mind is in such turmoil that for a moment he cannot tell whether he feels too hot or too cold. Just somehow all wrong. In the clothes he is wearing, the fabric too close to his skin, clinging as if he is still wet from the shower. In the midst of this panic he looks at his wife, but there is no support or comfort there, only terrible and wild confusion in her eyes.
Shall we go then, Mr. Ballard?
Henry thinks that perhaps he should ask whether he has a choice, whether this is an arrest or a request. Whether he should get Barbara to phone the lawyer, dig his heels in and actually refuse to go. But then he quickly regroups, thinking that he needs to be very, very careful. Saying the wrong thing or being uncooperative now could go very badly for him, could be entirely misunderstood. And so Henry Ballard stands, and as they walk outside, he tries to calm himself and decides, for now at least, to say nothing more at all.
Chapter 17. The Witness. I have been lying in bed, thinking about karma. Silly, I know, but that postcard has really gotten under my skin. I keep having these mixed-up dreams. Anna on the train, the noise of Sarah and her bloke in that wretched toilet cubicle, and then the shock over Luke and his girlfriend. I'm not one for popcorn psychiatry normally, but you can't miss the irony, can you? And it just feels, I don't know, as if everything in my life is trying to teach me some terrible lesson, and my brain just can't cope. Some nights it gets so bad, I get this tight feeling in my chest. Then I have to get up and make a cup of tea, and then, of course, Tony gets up too, worried sick, which is the last thing I want, spreading the guilt.
What I try to do is go over it in my mind when I am on my own, playing rewind to think over and over and over about exactly how responsible I am for whatever happened to that poor girl, wishing so much that I could go back and play it differently. And then, the problem is, hand on heart, I still cannot go back there in my mind's eye and be anything other than appalled at the thought of that girl and that man having sex in that toilet so soon after they met. I wish that I could bounce this off people properly, ask them openly what they would have done, whether they would be shocked or upset to be confronted by what I heard. The problem is that the police have only ever released information that the witness overheard the girls being chatted up by the guys just out of prison, and that the witness was shocked at how quickly they became close, how quickly they made unwise plans together, dangerous plans. I've been judged for that, and that alone, for not stepping in because two country girls were being so clearly targeted by two guys with records. That's what all the social media and tabloid press has been about. What would you have done? Would you have minded your own? 2 16-year-old girls, two guys just out of prison. The police have never released the detail of the sex in the toilet and asked me to keep it quiet for reasons of evidence, so I have only ever been able to tell Tony. He says I was right to be shocked and that people would keep their noses out of it if they knew all the facts. We've talked it over again since this business with Luke and his girlfriend, and Tony says it's very different. A young girl having sex with a virtual stranger in a public toilet, and Luke and Emily making a mistake in a caring relationship. I know he's right, but I still feel a bit hypocritical now for judging Sarah so very harshly. He's gone into work early today, my Tony. He's in retail himself, but a very different sector, selling cereals to supermarkets. He's acting regional manager and is up for the job permanently if his sales figures hit their target. I'm terribly proud of him, though it's a lot of pressure, and I wish he didn't have to do so much travelling. For now, with him away so much, I have promised to juggle my working hours so that I am not alone at the shop out of hours too much, at least not until we hear from the police and feel a bit steadier. So this feels odd for me. A second cup of coffee in bed. It's 8 a.m., which for a florist amounts to a lie-in. I'm having a really good think about karma. Also, whether I am a prude. I mean, I certainly hold my hands up to being a bit out of touch, naive to imagine that my 17-year-old son wouldn't be having sex yet. More and more I keep testing myself, worrying that I am a hypocrite over what happened on the train. Was my judgment about gender? Because my first thought was that Sarah clearly wasn't as nice a girl as I had imagined, which is why I stepped away from the whole situation. Yet, if it had been Luke? No, on reflection, maybe not so hypocritical, because I would still be totally appalled and shocked if a son of mine, or any young man, had done that with someone they had just met. Maybe the truth is that I just like some boundaries. Because, don't get me wrong, this is not about sex, per se. Tony and I get along very well in that department ourselves, thank you very much. I just think it's private. Sex. Not something casual. Something to be talked about with strangers at dinner parties. And certainly not something to share with a complete stranger in a train toilet. As for karma. But now my mobile is ringing. The display confirms it's Matthew Hill. I check my watch. 8:10. Hello, Matthew. I was going to ring you, actually, to let you know that the London DI has postponed. He's coming round later now. Has had to stay on in Cornwall for a bit. Some development with the inquiry, he said, which I'm hoping means progress. Well, I hate to disillusion you, but I'm afraid you can hold that thought. I've just spoken to my contact down in Cornwall, and apparently the investigation is suddenly all over the place, going right up a blind alley, from what I hear. But never mind that. Big news. I just got the call. My wife's gone into labour. I'm on my way to collect her right now. Feels a bit surreal, actually, but I just wanted to check in to let you know I may be out of the loop for a few days. A few days? I laugh. You may just have underestimated this, Matthew. But what lovely news. Please do let me know how it goes. Do you know if it's a boy or a girl yet?
No. Goodness, we don't mind.
Okay. Good luck. Drive carefully and try to calm down. I'll be in touch.